again, fellow travellers, and welcome to podcast 158 in the series You Should Have Been There, with me, Mick Webb.
And me, Simon Calder. And today our topic is border towns. How do you know when you're in one? We're going to try to answer that question, and in order to create the right kind of atmosphere, we're recording this podcast at a frontier of sorts, beside the bandstand at Clapham Common in South London, pretty much on the boundary between the London boroughs of Wandsworth and Lambeth.
And it is a beautiful sunny Sunday morning, and most of Clapham is taking advantage of it here. Before we delve more deeply into frontiers, I draw the line at saying take a deep dive into. Simon, I have to ask you a personal question. Was it you I spotted very briefly on Have I Got News For You, the very famous BBC satirical programme?
Well, I've not actually seen it. I can imagine the incident to which you refer. Let me take you back a few days. I was in a nameless Norwegian town, Fredrikstrand, in fact. Well, worth going to, south of Oslo. Lovely. GB News asked me to talk about the way that climate change could be increasing the amount of air turbulence. And therefore, since I like to think that I can explain concepts in travel, I said, of course I will. Anyway, there I am, sitting there, hooked up to Skype, which is these days the absolute normal way. I don't have much coming from the studio because they were on a break. And then suddenly the presenters come back, and I'm thinking, OK, well, it looks to me as though they're on air. You can't actually tell if you are. But they can't be, because one of the presenters has just uttered a profanity. And then it became clear that actually they were on air. And what can you do in that situation? All you can do is sit there straight-faced and prepare to tell people about air turbulence.
Well, I'm afraid Have I Got News For You didn't go on to that bit, but may I ask a question which various friends of mine have asked here in trendy South London, which is, what on earth were you doing on GB News, that bastion of, what shall we call it, traditionalist thinking?
But trying to change their traditionalist thinking, genuinely. It is an interesting station. There's certain shows on it I simply would not appear on. You can maybe guess the presenters. But otherwise, it gives you a really good opportunity to explain to an audience which perhaps is in support of Brexit just how utterly catastrophic Brexit has been for the British traveller. And I welcome that opportunity, and so I am happy to contribute, and I'll talk to them about other travel matters as well. I should also say that the backroom staff are young, bright, fun, creative, great, and I really enjoy working with them.
Well, there ends the case for the defence. Very good as well. But we should get on to our usual parish notices and news and views from listeners. Let's start with the subject of travelling footwear, our topic in You Should Have Been There podcast 157. And respect, if that is the right word, to Paul M, who tweeted the following. Perhaps that should be You Should Have Been There.
Oh, crikey. Thanks, Paul. Moving swiftly on, Anne Lander tweeted, can't understand why exactly the same shoes sometimes set off the airport scanner and sometimes don't. Well, as somebody who used to operate as a security officer, as I've mentioned once or twice before, at Gatwick Airport, different airlines tune their walk-through gates differently. You might also, and this particularly happens to me quite a lot when I'm wearing canvas shoes, which shouldn't trigger anything, you just get a random, and that just means, okay, have a look at this guy, even though we don't think there's anything wrong with him. Also on the footwear theme, Fiona Kennedy writes in to say, first day in Brisbane, staying with my cousin. My husband is up early and alone with Duncan for the first time. Duncan asks my Glaswegian husband, thanks for that detail, Fiona, if he'd like to put his thongs on and go to the lake. Husband doesn't know what to say or think until Duncan indicates some flip-flops. So yes, thongs are not things with which gentlemen guard their more private parts.
Well, we'll file that under shoe-related cultural misunderstandings. JT brought up travelling with no shoes at all. Respectfully, barefoot on wooden boards in front of a Thai Buddha monument. Don't tread on the metal nail heads. They get very hot in the sun.
Just keep moving, JT. Honestly, I found myself a week ago in exactly the same position. Well, not exactly the same position. I was in Arctic Norway, and I was faced with having to run from the sauna across what was apparently just volcanic debris to the cold shower. And the Norwegian guy who I was with just said, don't stop, just keep running. And it did sort of seem to work. So there we are.
A moving target.
Yes, and several responses, Mick, to your request for advice on the best single pair of shoes for travelling. Our dear friend Rebecca Halpin has her own formula. I take only one pair of shoes with me, which I wear, so I don't need to pack any. In winter, it's a smart but comfortable pair of ankle boots, which are equally suitable for walking around all day and going out for dinner. In warmer months, it's smart but comfortable sandals. I'm just looking down, Mick. I think you kind of almost make the smart ankle boots, although I can imagine there's one or two restaurants you wouldn't necessarily be welcomed into.
Yes, but I'm not sure I'd like to take these up into the higher mountains.
Well, on the other hand, or foot, Shamrock 1982 advises for a holiday where you'll be walking loads or long distances, like theme parks or the Vegas Strip, you have to be wearing a pair of Skechers memory foam trainers. Game changer, says Shamrock 1982. Thank me later. I will try that, and I will.
Well, I'll certainly look into it as well. And I like the idea of memory foam for some reason. Now, here's a location-specific lesson. The fruit of bitter experience. And it comes from Totally Beans. Always, always, always have flat and preferably grip-sole shoes in the Algarve. That's Portugal, south coast of Portugal. Made the mistake of going in December. Was unusually cold at night. Cobbles were like ice. Slipped, fell, and couldn't walk for 10 weeks. Loads of other people there on crutches or moon boots who suffered a similar fate.
Well, I'm really sorry to hear that, Totally Beans. I've got twinges from some ludicrously excitable walking I did on the Wild Atlantic Way in Ireland. I was in one of the most beautiful parts of the world. It was a wet, wet morning, as they sometimes are in Ireland, I've noticed, and I was striding through this ghost deserted village on Achill Island, absolutely spectacular, until my foot slipped and the other one in a kind of grass-based version of a skiing accident. My whole body collapsed onto my foot and my thigh, and I literally heard something snap, and I thought, oh no, things have gone really badly wrong. I'm going to be out of circulation for 10 weeks in the same way as Totally Beans. But in fact, I picked myself up. Nothing seemed to have snapped. Still the odd twinge, but if that's the worst that you get, then that's good. And of course, we've talked when hiking about the importance of not putting a foot wrong. I'd like, Mick, to mention this tweet from Christopher Noonan. I'm sure you're too modest to do so. Hey, Mick, when are you recording the second half of the Camino Inglés?
Oh, thank you so much for that, Christopher. Well, I hope that it will be next week, when we will also be talking, we hope, to someone who knows quite a lot more about all the different kinds of walking routes to Santiago de Compostela. Now, I think we were both intrigued by a tweet from another friend of the programme, Tim Coxon. Tim tweeted a map of Norway with a route marked on it and the heading Paul Heaton 1983, to which Tim had appended this note. What a fantastic idea to relive your youthful travels in a virtual realm.
Tim, I'm so grateful to you bringing this to our attention. What it refers to is a sequence of tweets from the great Paul Heaton, legendary singer-songwriter from the House Martins and Beautiful South. In 1983, he went hitchhiking around Europe. And what he's been doing is providing, effectively, a daily diary bulletin of his hitchhiking trip exactly 40 years ago, which he evidently documented splendidly. He tweeted to introduce this on the 15th of May, and you can follow him at Paul Heaton Solo on Twitter. To celebrate its 40 years passing, I'm hoping to do a Twitter retrace of my 1983 European hitchhiking trip. A trip lasting almost 2 months, 12 countries, and one that changed me as a young person. I'll be setting off from a virtual Victoria bus station in London at about 5 p.m. Which way will I be going? Follow the map. And you can do just that at Paul Heaton Solo.
And if you do, you can follow Paul's progress day by day. Here, for example, is his tweet from May the 22nd. 22nd, 5th, 1983. More bread and cheese, and we set off for, well, it's spelt Gol, but I think it's pronounced, is it Yol in Norwegian?
Probably, yeah.
Probably. Oslo, if we're lucky. First lift at 1:15. Young woman in a VW Beetle drops us halfway to Yol in a place called Al. Probably Ull. to our wait in the cold, then a chap in a VW 10-seater spoke English, heating, and Joni Mitchell on full blast, heaven. Plus, he was going all the way to Oslo. A little stop in Hønefoss, and we reach Oslo at 7:30. We hang around the fountain in the main square and are surrounded by a mad mix of sex workers, drug dealers, new romantics, and travellers. It already feels like a long way from Bergen.
Looking forward to following the rest of Paul's progress, but it involved, of course, crossing multiple borders, as did my recent expedition cycling, effectively, the Neisser and the Oder, which form the border between Germany and Poland. And I went all the way, really, from the Czech frontier, one of those three country points, to the Baltic Sea. And I kept crossing between the two, and the funny thing was, every time you went over to the Polish side at the border town, all there was wall-to-wall advertisements for cigarettes in German. So we put out there on Twitter, how do you know you're in a border town? And we also would like to introduce a third presenter to our programme. Let's call her Dervler. And here's what she has to say. How do you know when you're in a border town?
There are several indicators that can help you determine if you are in a border town. Here are some common signs to look out for. Geographical location. Border towns are typically situated near national or international borders. If you are in a town that is close to a border, it's likely you are in a border town. Border crossing facilities. One of the most obvious signs is the presence of border crossing points such as checkpoints, customs offices, or immigration stations. Facilities are often located at entry and exit points of a country and indicate that you are in a border town. Bilingual or multilingual signage. In many border towns, you might notice that signs and notices are displayed in multiple languages. This is done to cater to the needs of travelers and residents from both sides of the border. Cultural diversity. Border towns often have a unique blend of cultures and influences from neighboring countries. You might notice a mix of languages, traditions, and cuisines that differ from those in the interior regions of the country. Duty-free shops or outlets offering products from the neighbouring country can also be common in such towns.
Where did you find Dervler, Simon?
I found Dervler by going to ChatGPT, putting in that very question, and then finding a voice synthesizer app. So, well, that's the future of podcasting, Mick. I'm afraid you and I might well be on the way out in more senses than one. But since you are still just about human and quite intelligent, let me ask you how you know when you're in a border town.
I think I know that I'm in a border town. By the way, there are any number of bicycles, dogs, buggies passing by.
If I may, just looking beyond the bandstand, there is an Airbus A380 belonging to Emirates, which is just on its way to Dubai. We are connected with the world here on the boundary between Lambeth and Wandsworth. They're on Eastleys today, leaving Heathrow.
Well, many people wouldn't have known that, but you ask me how I would know when I'm in a border town, and I think it is when I feel that I don't want to stay there any longer than I absolutely have to. but my first question to you would be not so much what is in them, but are they ever nice?
I think they are. I was really taken by the border between Poland and Germany because, well, actually, during the Cold War, it wasn't really much of a frontier at all because it was the German Democratic Republic, East Germany on one side, Poland on the other, all owned and operated by the Kremlin. And so none of the usual tensions. Frankfurt an der Oder, which, of course, was utterly devastated in the Second World War, the German border town, very pleasant. And there's even another one a little bit further north where you are told this is the start of Bundesstraße 1, and it goes all the way across through Berlin, through Cologne, to Aachen, and to the Dutch border. So, or Belgian border, I believe. So a real sense of crossing borders. And, of course, these days within the European Union, well, you shouldn't see any border formalities. Having said that, coming in from Poland to Frankfurt an der Oder, there were a whole group of German frontier police who were effectively profiling people in their cars. And older British gentlemen on bicycles were not troubled.
Well, I think possibly the most interesting border towns are those where the border actually runs right through the middle of them. And if it's not too much of a self-indulgence, can I refer you to our famous book, Backpacks, Boots and Baguettes, from somewhere around 2004-2005, in which we walked through the Pyrenees, and that included walking through the border town of Le Pertus, which then becomes La Junquera or La Jonquera in Spain. And this is what we thought of it at the time. I don't really think it's changed very much. In fact, the next stretch of the GR10, the path we were on... Oh, Simon's just got up to take part in a game of football. There we go. Oh, no, he's... he's ricochet off a lamppost. Yeah. And now he's rejoined us for... in fact, the next stretch of the GR10, the path we were on, becomes something of a historical pageant. The interesting sights contrasting sharply with the walk itself, which is boring and tiring and leads into the traffic-clogged town of Le Pertus. We pulled no punches, did we? None of our guidebooks, nor us, I think, had a kind word to say for modern Le Pertus, although if you're a collector of frontier towns, it does have a curious kind of charm. One side of the road is French and the other side is Spanish. And while the Spanish part is devoted to the sale of cheap booze and cigarettes, the French side of things is more concerned with nice boulangerie, charcuterie and pâtisseries. Shopping was more fun here before the advent of the euro, as you could wander into the shops without being at all certain whether you needed francs or pesetas, let alone which language you were supposed to be speaking or whether you were getting a good deal.
Let me take you straight to the ultimate border town. I think it has to be. This is Bijlhertog if you're in Belgium, or Bijlmersel if you're in the Netherlands. And you can cross between them about 15 times in 5 minutes, because it's as though this international frontier with lots and lots of little enclaves and exclaves was created by somebody who had spent rather too long drinking excellent Belgian or possibly Dutch beer. Let me just bring you what the local council of Belgium says. On the ground floor, this is the town hall, okay? On the ground floor, the boundary line crosses diagonally through the police office, where Belgian and Dutch police officers work side by side. On the first floor, the same border line passes through the council room. During council meetings, some of the council members have their seat on Dutch territory. This, however, does not affect the validity of council decisions. But when the mayor performs a wedding in the council room, he, interesting assumption there, must ensure the deed is signed on Belgian territory. If not, the marriage would be legally invalid. And it's a fascinating place. And you can quite happily be sitting as we are here, having a cup of coffee, and one of you is in the Netherlands and the other one is in Belgium. Well worth seeing. Not far from the fine, I would say, Dutch city of Eindhoven, which you can get to for about 20 quid from Stansted on good old Ryanair.
Yes, of course, bearing in mind that it would be environmentally much better to go by train. Now, there is, of course, a formerly divided city with one of the world's most famous, or should I say infamous, border crossings in it, Berlin, which we talked about in our very first podcast. You should have been there, number one. And here you were on the subject of Checkpoint Charlie.
What a great experience that was. And I really, of course, it was a cruel, horrible crossing. Checkpoint Charlie, it was called, because if you were in the Allies after the war, the first crossing was from West Germany, the French, British, American part, into East Germany, the Soviet part, go through at Checkpoint Charlie, somewhere near Braunschweig. You then get to the outskirts of West Berlin and the border there, and that was Checkpoint Bravo. And then finally, if you wanted to carry on through there and go into the heart of East Berlin, you go through Checkpoint Charlie. And that's how it got the name. And just such an atmospheric place. And the you could feel the tension. And yes, it was. I just went across there once on foot. And you are just scrutinised to within an inch of your life. They will be checking all your money to make sure you haven't been doing any black market negotiating. And the cars were even worse because, of course, the standard way to get across was to compress yourself into the size of a small domestic animal and hide in the boot. So just so good.
Well, of course, Berlin looks very different now, but can you still spot the join?
Well, you can do, because it has become a tourist industry. And I'm uncommonly glad that I was, in the frozen January of 1989, able to cross Checkpoint Charlie with the full panoply of checks by the East German frontier officials, because it was an extraordinary experience. Now it's all manufactured. There is at Checkpoint Charlie a really interesting and free exhibition. A couple of streets downwards, the Checkpoint Charlie Museum, which actually predates the unification of Germany. And everywhere you go, for instance, on Unter den Linden, the kind of main thoroughfare, which was horribly interrupted, they've now got pretend border posts and they've got pretend East German guards, and you can pose for social media with them for a couple of euros.
So can you be put in a boot of a car and smuggled across for 50 euros or not?
That's an interesting proposition. And of course, there's still various parts where the war still stands. In particular, there's one stretch where with some magnificent street art. So it's, I would say, probably the top thing to do in Berlin is to go on the old Berlin Wall Trail, much the same, well, let's move to Belfast, as if you are making a tour of the West Belfast areas, which were divided by the so-called Peace Wall, which is still there. Extraordinary times.
Yeah. Well, I mean, border towns do have, I mean, apart from the obvious sort of architectural reminders of hard times past, something of a special atmosphere, which is hard to put your finger on, but is often a feeling I get of impermanence, unease, menace, quite a lot of military, obviously, sadly, sometimes huge quantities of refugees. But on the credit side, you get a sense of the comings and goings of different cultures and countries, and huge historical changes and sort of mixtures of architecture. Now, have you ever been to Colonia del Sacramento?
I'm thrilled to say I have, and if I might just place it, it is on the River Plate, at the point at which that estuary is, I don't know, 20 miles wide, on the Uruguay side, with a tolerably all right ferry link from Buenos Aires to international one. Great.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, it is a frontier between Argentina and Uruguay. And it used to be on a very changeable frontier between the great colonial powers of Portugal and Spain. And so if you look closely or get a guided tour, which is a lot easier, you can actually walk up and down these different cobbled streets, which are extremely beautiful, and find that some of them date from the Portuguese period of occupation and some from the Spanish times. And the differentiation is that, and I can't remember which way around it is, that in one of them the sort of drainage channel goes down the middle of the street, and in the other it goes down the sides. Anyway, just one of a number of intriguing facts about that.
Okay, well, I'm going to take you very briefly to Narva in Estonia, a real border town. This is where Estonia meets Russia. Of course, within the Soviet Union, it was all basically the same place. Now you are in this magnificent location overlooking the Narva River. Russian trucks coming and going 24 hours a day. And most of the people you meet in the bars are indeed Russian speaking. Well worth going there. And the other place, of course, very familiar with us, Calais, formerly for a time part of England, and still very much the sense of a border town.
And of course, you have a concrete reminder of the coming and going of Calais in the 12 Burghers of Calais, Rodin's famous sculpture, which commemorates the moment when England first won it from the French after a serious siege.
That statue, by the way, very impressive, pretty much in the middle of Calais, directly opposite, would you believe, the Café de l'Hovercraft. Yes, the Hovercraft Café, which has outlived the actual Aéroglissière, and strongly to be recommended. And thanks to Sam, the very senior civil servant whose second name cannot be revealed, but introduced me to this fine place. Anytime you're in Calais, seek out the Hovercraft.
I certainly will. And I'm sure that we have, while pointing out one or two characteristics of border towns, have missed out quite a few others. Casinos springs to mind. But please do get in touch with us and let us know your experiences of border towns, good, bad, and observations as to what it is that characterises them.
You can tweet us at YouShouldHaveBT, or why don't you leave us an audio message? Easiest thing in the world. Just go to anchor.fm/YouShouldHaveBeenThere and follow the online instructions.
So until next week, from me, Mick Webb.
And me, Simon Calder. Goodbye.
Goodbye.